Only if you're ready, 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 ready. Let's go.
Hello and welcome to Divine Enigma, a podcast that talks about how to navigate through the complexities of the workplace as a modern day professional while simultaneously having a side hustle. We appreciate all of our audience members for taking some time out of their day to tune into another episode and look forward to providing you all some value through our show today. My name is Sarah and I will be your host for this podcast. This podcast will be available on all platforms where you can find podcasts, including Spotify, Amazon and Apple Podcasts, and we're also on YouTube. So when you're on YouTube, please tick the bell and subscribe. Thank you. I hope you look forward to today's show. Hello and welcome to Divine Enigma, Shay Ejedekun. So Shay Ejedekun has written a book called Black and Neurodiverse. She's a marketer and she's going to talk us about her journey of navigating her neurodiverse conditions, what type of neurodiverse conditions she has and how that has helped her but also hindered her along her career path. So Shay, welcome to Divine Enigma. And thank you so much for coming on the show. It's been an absolute honor to have you on the show. I've been watching you a lot on socials and I love what you do. And I love the fact that you're so empowered by your neurodiversity. It's very, very hard sometimes to see people that look like us, like Black females, in a space where we're not always allowed to be in that space sometimes, or will always acknowledge. I know a few people in that space, but not many that look like us. So I'm really glad that you're on today's show.
Thank you for having me. No, really looking forward to it. And just like speaking more about some of my experiences.
So it would be really good for those who don't know about the book you wrote, Black and Neurodiverse. What inspired you to write it? What were you hoping that people would get from reading this book, and that who was your target when you were thinking about writing this? Because you talk a lot about how you grew up being Nigerian and neurodiverse as well.
I feel like I was diagnosed quite later on in life. I was about 20 years old when I was diagnosed, and I remember just not really understanding or knowing what it was. So I remember they said I had dyslexia, dyspraxia, dyscalculia, and I just didn't really know what that meant. So I went on this journey to just learn more about it. And as I was learning more about it, I decided to write the book for myself, but also for other people, because at the time I couldn't find many books or videos of people who were neurodiverse and looked like me. So I really wanted to speak to that experience, although I felt like I was still navigating it at the time. And then also, actually, I was quite inspired by a Steve McQueen small film where they were speaking about the British education system in the 60s. Mm-hmm. I remember watching it and crying because I felt like the experience of the Black man in the film, or the Black boy in the film, was the same experience as mine. And I felt like this was set in the 60s. And I definitely didn't go to school in the 60s. And it's just a shame. It's a shame that it feels like not much had changed. So I really wanted to write a book that would speak to the school experience, especially for educators as well. I thought it might be helpful for them to be able to put themselves in the shoes of a young Black neurodiverse gal from the Midlands. The book is about my lived experience, but also as I was researching, found some statistics I thought it would be really helpful for people to know. So I made sure to include it within it.
When you found that you had a neurodiverse condition, and you had a number of different neurodiverse conditions, how did your family react to that? Yeah. And how did they feel about knowing that they had a neurodiverse, particularly your parents, how they felt they had a neurodiverse daughter?
To be honest, I think I was quite fortunate because actually I struggled a lot through school. So when it came to my GCSEs, it was after quite a few like attempts. And I think for them, there definitely were questions of, okay, there's definitely something more happening here. So I think their response was one of acceptance, which I think can be quite rare for someone from an African and maybe even a Caribbean background. But definitely was more of a response of acceptance. And I think we were all on this journey together to find out, okay, so what does this mean? And what support, most importantly, what support can I get? And so that I think, especially for my mum, she was big on pushing, get that support. Anything they offer, anything they can give you, make sure you utilize it and take advantage of it. Yeah. And I'm very glad that I did, because it helped me so, so much. I remember growing up in school, seeing people with maybe it was different colored paper or a laptop or just different resources that helped them. And the fact that I now had access to this, it just made a world of a difference for me. And you could even see it in regard to like the results and my grades. They improved a lot just because of it.
Just because you got the support.
Yeah.
It's interesting you talk about like the fact you had really supportive parents. Mm. I think my parents were a bit mixed in the terms of they supported me in their own way. So I think... And I really think this is as long as I can remember, and I'm in my late 30s. Mm. I believe I had dyslexia from the age of 6. I really believed I had dyslexia, but it wasn't actually diagnosed. But I knew that for whatever reason, compared to everybody in my class, I wasn't picking up. So for a long time, I would mask my disability and find ways around trying to disguise the fact I had dyslexia. Mm. So I kind of like, I never, like when I was in the school system, they kind of missed me along the school system because I was so good at masking and pretending that I didn't have dyslexia. And also my parents, because my dad kind of had this inclination that maybe, you know, my daughter could be dyslexic, but they were worried about having me being labeled in school. So my biggest thing for my parents was the fact that they didn't want me to be labeled, they didn't want me to be a target, they didn't want me to have to think about, okay, this is another thing that she's gonna have to deal with, because already there's this stigma of being black and also being female and always us kind of being at the bottom of the potent toe in terms of the help that we get and support we get. So what my parents did as a way of kind of not making me feel different or making sure that I wasn't behind is they put me in extra, they gave me extra like classes or got me a private tutor. Mm. So once a week I used to have a private tutor that I went to, and that tutor would help with my English and my mathematics. And I also went to a Saturday school as well. Mm. So it was almost like for me, I got support, but in a different way, but it was a support where they would try to prevent me from being stigmatized. Mm. Because it was a something that they didn't want me to deal with. And I guess it was good that you had that support where you had all the resources to get, but I didn't get that until probably in my mid-20s, where I went to university and I was struggling with essay writing, really struggling with essay writing. I had all the ideas in my head, but I just didn't know how to express it. Like, I knew the information, but for whatever reason, there's this part of my brain that just couldn't express what I was learning. I can talk for days. I can say exactly what you told me, but I just couldn't express it in essays. And I would always do really badly in essays. And they had like an essay, like, what they call them now? I don't know whether they still have it then, but it was like you go to this... tutor that you can get help with your essay writing. So it was like an essay workshop or a one-stop shop you can go to get help for essay writing. Mm. And I went there and the woman was like, you probably have dyslexia. And I was like, really? She's like, yeah, you have dyslexia, maybe you should go and get tested. And it was only after I finished my degree, when I went on to do my postgraduate, that's when I got a proper diagnostics of dyslexia. And I got the diagnostic test, obviously you must know, it's quite intense. Mm-hmm. It's something like 2 hours long. It's like you're doing gymnastics with your brain. It was really intense, but I was so glad to have done it because it kind of gave me this, okay, what I knew from when I was 6 years old was actually confirmed and in writing. So every time I go everywhere, I kind of like say, this is, I'm dyslexic and this is the evidence to prove that I am. Mm. I was also diagnosed not only with dyslexia, but I was also diagnosed with ADD. So it's called ADHD because they've kind of put the two types of function of ADD and ADHD. But when I got diagnosed, it was ADD, which was attention deficit disorder, and the H was the hyperactivity. So I didn't have the hyperactivity, but I didn't pay attention for long periods of time. So I go into two modes with ADHD in terms of I either procrastinate and do absolutely nothing, or I go into hyperfocus. And then with the dyslexia, that it takes a long time to express my thought processes. But because of like, over time I've learned to have techniques. So for example, when I'm trying to get my ideas out, I have talk and text. So I talk and then the ideas are written for me. And I'm like, okay, that gives me the space not to have this information in my head that I can't quite express it because I'm overthinking about how to spell a word or put it together. So, yeah, my experience was quite different, but it's quite good that your parents were very, very supportive and actually encouraged you to get that support. And it's important for people who are dyslexic or have any neurodiverse condition, get the support. Don't suffer in silence and just act like everything is fine, because there are people out there that can help you. I remember we had a conversation before this podcast, and you kind of said that you were working in different companies, and some companies you were quite open to tell them about your neurodiverse conditions and some you didn't tell. Do you want to explore that and talk about that in a little bit more detail?
Sure. So I'd probably say when it comes to just being neurodiverse at work, I'm still navigating that like early on into my career. But I can definitely say it's come with hurdles, which I'm thankful to have overcome. And sometimes that's looked like a change of workplace in regard to the environment and really inquiring about the support that I can get within the workplace. I remember like the first job that I had after university, not wanting to tell them or not knowing if I should tell them. And eventually they realized when some of the copy was misspelt. I remember being in a workplace where potentially I told them and it didn't seem to be received too well. I'm very grateful to be in a workplace at the moment where I really do feel like there's support there, and whether it's diversity and inclusion or neurodiversity, I think those are areas that they're really looking to champion. So definitely still navigating it. And also even for myself personally, trying to find some things that will be helpful for me within the workplace. So trying to think of specific examples for things that I've used to help me in the workplace. Sometimes, I don't know if I should reveal this, but sometimes ChatGPT has been a helpful one, or there's even a plugin that I have that can make text lowercase or make text more bold when viewing it. So just really trying to find some shortcuts and tips for me that will work well. Sometimes these are things, not even sometimes, majority of the time, these are things that people from the outset or offset wouldn't necessarily know. But yeah, definitely makes my life just that bit more easier.
ChatGPT is actually a godsend. It's actually really helpful. I don't use it in the sense that I take all the information from it, but what I do is it kind of triggers the idea in my head. So where I'm not able to express my ideas, I go, okay, what does ChatGPT say? And then I'll take it and I'll kind of run with it, change things around, make it sound like a bit like me. And then that can help me produce better copy or better like articles or like blogs if I want to. But yeah, ChatGPT is a very, very useful tool, and I think it's a good thing to use, particularly if you're dyslexic or have a neurodiverse condition. Doesn't mean that you use it and you just take copy paste and that's it, that like you do have to make the effort, but it just makes your job a little easier in terms of like if you're trying to produce work but you're having a brain like freeze. And I have loads of brain freezes a lot of the time, and it is something that occurs to me every day at work. Like some days I'm just like, What am I supposed to be doing today? And I don't even know how to prioritize my day. But yeah, the tools are out there, and I think it's important to use those tools because then you can be more empowered to do your job as best as you can. So yeah, I love that.
Yeah.
I wanted to talk more around like what was school like for you, like in terms of making friendships and talking to having relationships with, you know, being neurodiverse. And I can talk to you about my experience, but I want to, this is, you're the guest, so I want to make sure I get more from you.
Yeah, no problem. I think when it comes to primary school, I think very early on, I remember being taken out of the classroom or being seated on like tables with other children who may have had like learning differences or conditions. And I wonder if I thought much about it. I definitely remember the feelings of how I felt, which was very much like othered in a way. And I don't think this was really communicated to my parents. I don't really think they knew what was going on. I don't think they knew I was taken out of the classroom a lot of the time or seated on like what I would call the yellow table at the time. So I think in terms of confidence, yeah, I think it affected my confidence back then.
So the special kids table.
Like very early on, I remember when it came to secondary school, actually performing like very well in my SATs beforehand to get there, and that's because it had a reader when it came to my SATs, and this was just literally someone who would read the questions to me, and for some reason it meant that I did very well, better than what I was doing before. So when I remember going to secondary school, when I got to secondary school, I remember when it came to sets, they had like 5 sets. So I started off all like set 2, you know, like quite high sets. And then very quickly I was moved down. And it was a shame because even in the sets, I couldn't help but think that sometimes in regard to the attention or the effort of the teachers, I think it varied. Like I remember being in set 4 and the classroom being like large, and there were disruptions when it came to like the students. And I think looking back, I could definitely see that a lot of these children, I don't think they just had like behavioral like issues. I think a lot of us were neurodivergent. And I remember when I felt like it all changed for me when it came to education and just doing well. And that was when I moved to a school where there was diversity, there was representation in regard to the teachers. I remember just feeling like for the first time I had teachers who really, really cared and were going to go the extra mile for all of their students to do well if they wanted to. I remember having a black teacher for the first time, a Jewish teacher for the first time, Asian teachers for the first time. And I know, like, it may sound normal, but for me, that was amazing. And I remember really enjoying it. I remember feeling, like, included. I remember just feeling safe, comfortable, to be honest. And in regard to, like, my academics, like, they improved so much. So, yeah, I remember really enjoying that phase of my life. That was, like, sixth form. And so I think with all of the different experiences, though, I am grateful for them all because I definitely can say I learned loads of different things. And even if it was like GCSEs and secondary school and resitting on quite a few occasions, I definitely learned resilience, to which I can see like I definitely still have that. I think it was unfortunate. I definitely do feel like I was missed out of the system because I didn't know I was neurodivergent until my second year of university, you know.
It's always the case.
Yeah.
Like people always, like when I speak to so many people who, you know, who don't look like the typical, you know, neurodivergent person or disabled person or someone with an intellectual disability, you know, they don't get, they get kind of left behind or not noticed. And it's only when you go to university, and in the case of me, I had finished university, that only then I got to find out I was neurodiverse. And I know there's a lot of people that sometimes it evokes different types of feelings. Some people feel a sense of relief. Some people feel quite angry sometimes that I've gone through the system, I didn't get support. And it can host a whole like concoction of emotions, just dealing with the fact that you could have got support, or why didn't you know about this earlier? Yeah, I generally get that.
It really makes me wonder, though, what about the people who don't make it to university? Yeah.
What about the people that don't make it? It does make me wonder, because it depends. I find that people who don't make it to university and maybe have neurodiverse conditions, they may end up just starting their own business or working for themselves, or they might fall into some kind of fortune of working for an employer that understands they have a neurodiverse condition. Mm. But that might not always be the case. And a lot of the time we always think neurodiverse, because there's always this thing as well about, if you're a neurodiverse person, you have a superpower, or you're this and that. But we have to be quite, I think we have to be very mindful, and we have to be realistic about what it is to have a neurodiverse condition every day. Like the day-to-day lived experience of someone who's neurodiverse. Some neurodiverse people, they cannot get a job and stay in that job for more than 2 weeks because they just can't cope with the work. There's some neurodiverse people that they have aspirations to do better, but because nobody can see beyond their neurodiverse condition, they're stuck in jobs that maybe that they don't really want to do, and it's not challenging them because people make the assumption they can't do anything more than what they're doing. They're not given those chances or opportunities. And then there's things like sometimes some neurodiverse people just can't do more than what they can do, and that's okay. Because neurodiversity is a spectrum. So there's some people that are autistic and they're nonverbal. And because they're nonverbal and autistic, they can't do jobs in the same way that maybe they can't be like a marketing manager or a communications or project manager, because they can't communicate. They may only be able to communicate via writing, and they might go into be doing poetry or writing or working in an area where they can just, you know, flourish with their skills. And also we have to also talk about the intersectionality of like race, poverty, and access to the support they can get. So when we look at people that are neurodiverse, a lot of the neurodiverse people that are kind of put in the headlines are sort of white men with privilege. I know there's two white, very well-known white men with privilege. So the guy that owns Lad Bible, he's neurodiverse. But you have to also look at it from a point of view. He has ADHD, but he comes from privilege in the sense that he has access to resources to support his ADHD. And then the guy who won... I can't remember his name, but he won I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of the Jungle. I think his name's called Sam. I can't remember his last name, but he's also neurodiverse. He's very open about his ADHD, but again, he's a white man with privilege. So when we see the face of neurodiversity, we always take the assumption it's white men. Just like when we talked about neurodiversity or ADHD, we used to think about ADHD in little white boys in the 90s. So in the 90s, it was a very big thing where a lot of kids were being diagnosed with a neurodiverse condition, which is ADHD. It's now become more common that girls have ADHD. But it was a thing where a lot of girls, it was always seen like it never existed in girls. Although, how can that be possible if only boys, little white boys, have ADHD? So sometimes you'll see a little white boy in Tesco and he's screaming and crying to his mum. And so he has ADHD. And he gets the treatment and help he needs for his ADHD. And it's only now that we're seeing that ADHD isn't just white little boys crying in Tesco. Not that their experience isn't valid, but it's a case of that we need to see more a perspective of what the neurodiversity umbrella holds, because there's some neurodiverse people, many neurodiverse people, I feel like get left along the sideline, and if they don't have that a platform or some kind of privilege that can enable them to manage their neurodiverse condition, it's almost like it gets dismissed and only people with superpowers who have neurodiverse conditions can be in part of this club. And that's what I almost find sometimes within our community, the neurodiverse community, there's a certain degree of prejudice against certain neurodiverse types that people don't want to talk about. I don't know whether you want to kind of touch on that, because it's something I've noticed over some time since like researching and understanding more about neurodiversity.
I can't help but feel that when it comes to like people being diagnosed, I think there's still a big issue there. I think it's really difficult for people to get diagnosed because it can be quite expensive. If you, like, for example, if you don't do it through the university, like, it can range from like £500 to £3,000 depending on what
exactly.
It is. That's disposable income that a lot of people don't have, and it's not necessarily a guarantee that they will have it. So I think there's definitely like a whole group of people who are neurodiverse but may not necessarily know, or they don't have the formal diagnosis, and I think that's an issue that definitely like needs to be addressed.
And the waiting lists, the NHS waiting list, exactly.
And I think it's quite sad, but I think a lot of those people are people from immigrant backgrounds, and you know, like, yeah, they're not middle class people, I like to say. I don't think
yeah.
I think it definitely affects like Black people a lot, African Caribbean people a lot. I think they even said like in the prison system as well, they looked at statistics and quite a lot of people happen to be neurodiverse. So I think, yeah, it's definitely it's a shame, and I hope that like there's something that can be done to like address this, because
I think a lot of the time within the UK everything's always firefighting, like we only deal with the things that are urgent or dangerous, not like things that can be cultivated or nurtured or impacted over time. So for example, if we had laws, I guess, that enabled people to get neurodiversity tests when they're younger, we may not have such long waiting lists. It might not end up becoming a crisis. But what happens is before anything's done, which I've noticed that happens in government settings, is that unless something's a crisis, then it's not important. We have so many crises in this country, but nobody is doing anything radical to do it, unless then everything is falling apart. So there's a housing crisis, there's, you know, there's a poverty, there's a cost of living crisis, there's loads of things that are affecting people, where households are being hit by poverty and being hit by difficult circumstances, and only when a crisis occurs, that's when the government will hand out something. And even what they hand out something is just for the now. It's not substantial or long-term to maintain people's lives in a sustainable way. I don't think people are asking for a lot. They're just asking for the basics, the necessities. And I think it should be a basic human right to get a neurodiversity assessment test done. So at least you can function, you know, and give back to society in the way that you can. Nobody wants to have a neurodiverse condition and be working in a world that is neurotypical, that's not working for them. It's just like if you're a wheelchair user and there are no ramps and you can't get anywhere, and there's no lifts, there's nowhere for you to get, it just makes things hard for you. So imagine that from a neurological perspective, where you're trying to understand things but you don't have the tools there to give you that support. So I feel like if there's a lot of radical changes within government, it will make life a lot easier. And obviously for us not to firefight when things get to a breaking point, which it is already, because obviously we're quite aware of in some areas. And I know I've looked in some areas of the country just to get an ADHD assessment, just that, or even an autism assessment. Some parts of the country, you have to wait for 5 years. 5 years. So imagine you're sitting there waiting, you put your name on the waiting list, and you're waiting for 5 years just to find out if you have this. And then when you do find out you have this, what do you do with that? What support are you going to be given along the way? Because sometimes the information to get that support isn't readily and easily available for all. So there's a lot. There's a lot to kind of unpack with that. But yeah, I do kind of think what you're saying around like rich middle class or really wealthy people who can give their the family members or their children's support on it, it makes it easier for them, rather than people that don't come from backgrounds where the resources is just not available and they're just trying to get by each day. And, you know, imagine if you have a child with ADHD and or autism and you don't have money, you're just like, I need to just get food on the table. I can't, I can't think about getting an assessment for this child and desperately needing that assessment because it's hard. So yeah, definitely. I do think more about that. I wanted to kind of touch more about what impact do you think your book would have on other people? Because you wrote the book, when did you write the book? It was about a couple of years back now. What impact do you think it will have on people today and their views of neurodiversity?
Yeah. So I'd probably say for two groups of people. I really wanted to write it for what I would say my community of African parents, aunties, uncles, Caribbean, because I kind of felt like when it comes to disability, sometimes there can be kind of stigma or stigmatized, and like people don't really want to have that conversation, or we don't say that. And I really wanted to share about my lived experience, hoping that it would inspire other people to be a bit more open when it comes to having those conversations, or maybe getting tested, having the assessment. So yeah, I really wanted to speak to that group, but also I really wanted to speak to people who maybe they're not African, they're not Caribbean, but they just want a bit more insight into the experience of someone who is navigating this, or maybe educators as well who would be teaching these children, just to have a bit more insight into what it's like to walk through their shoes. And also, I didn't want to just write about my lived experience. I wanted there to be some research, I wanted there to be statistics, and it was really interesting to find that like looking back even in the 60s and at the education system, how there's a bit of a bias there, there are some things behind the scenes that kind of contribute to like children being missed out in the UK school system, like discrimination and everything. So I thought it was really important to not just write about my experience and not just randomly write about these statistics, but also try and look at the history of like the Caribbean children who came in the 60s, who were just really navigating and going through like school.
Can I ask you a question? Why do you think, particularly within the African and also, oh, let's include the Caribbean community, that there is such a stigma about intellectual disability? Why do you think that is, from that perspective?
Sure. I wish I could say I had the answer, but I do think there needs to be more like education and more conversation about how it's not like, it doesn't need to be stigmatized. It's not necessarily a bad thing. I don't really know the history and why there may be a stigma when it comes to disability or when it comes to neurodiversity, but It may be a thing of like, they don't want it to be a hindrance. I think it can be hard already when it comes to like diversity and inclusion and discrimination and trying to just navigate like the UK alone. So I think to add that on top of it, I think that maybe they see the stigma, maybe they see not identifying with it as a way of protecting one. But I do believe that once there's more conversations and there's more understanding, like there's not as much stigma, or there's not as much fear when it comes to having these conversations.
Yeah, I agree. I think sometimes when I think about the community I come from, the African community, I feel like they don't understand what neurodiversity is. Generally, if you went to Africa or even went to Nigeria or Ghana, they don't actually understand what it is. I remember many, many, many years ago, I had an auntie, and I've mentioned this on my previous podcast episode. And she actually, I kind of said to her, I have dyslexia. She's like, oh, is that Down syndrome? And I was like, huh? She's like, yeah, is that Down syndrome? And I'm thinking, auntie, it's not Down syndrome. It's not the same thing. And then she's like, oh, okay. Because I thought that's the same thing. So sometimes it's just the fact that they're just not understanding what it means. Not that there's anything wrong with someone who has Down syndrome, but the two are not the same. And someone who has dyslexia and someone who has Down syndrome is a extra chromosome, which means that someone is born with Down syndrome because they're born with an extra chromosome. But it's not the same as someone being dyslexic. And so a lot of the time, I think it's just the lack of education and not actually understanding that. Also, there's also these kind of misconceptions that it's a curse. So like, you know, if you have somebody who's an autistic child, for example, it's a curse. You know, there's a sort of the religion aspect of being African as well. It comes into it. So I'm aware of some people in my community that have autistic children, and we can see the child is autistic, but the mum is like, no, I don't want to even talk about that. You're saying negative things about my child. It's not true. And it's not even like it's a negative thing. It's just that you have a son who has this condition and you need to give him the support he needs. But she refuses to do that because she doesn't want to acknowledge her son has this condition. So sometimes it's even like them confronting like that as a problem or issue. They don't want to confront it. So they kind of park it and say it doesn't exist. It's not real. It's the devil, you know. And, you know, I've spoken around like Christianity and a religious aspect around like talking about neurodiverse conditions, and some people seeing it as a curse, like someone has cursed you, that's why your child is that way, or you've been cursed or hexed, that's why you're like that. And I thought maybe you can draw into that because I believe you're Christian as well.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think on those kind of things that I've come across within my own community? And I see that quite often, where a lot of the time they just don't want to accept that is because they see it as a, you're calling upon the curse, or it's not something God wants.
You can only say like my viewpoint on it. So I can't help but think as a Christian that God is a God of diversity in all of the things that he's created. And I think when it comes to the brain, why would it be any different? So I think when one has the support needed, and I know people don't like the whole superpower analogy, but I can't help but think that like a lot of good things can come from someone who has support. And I think by ignoring something doesn't necessarily mean that it goes away. And I think actually when you can acknowledge that, okay, this person may be neurodiverse, whether it's ADHD, whether it's autism, or what it may be, it means that now, like, they can actually get the support they need. I think when it's ignored, and I think when they can't get diagnosed, like, this child is still going to be suffering, this child is still going to be struggling, because they now, they can't get that support that maybe they're entitled to. So I think it's not a matter of ignoring the situation, but I think it's a matter of understanding more than anything else, and understanding the condition, yes, but also understanding like specific needs of that individual, because I think it can vary from person to person.
Yeah, definitely. And I think a lot of the time, one of the I'm not really into toxic positivity.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's like a case of like you want to be positive even when things are bad. And you know what, it's actually good to allow things to go bad, because it's not something, we're not supposed to have everything easy in life. So when people are this, have this toxic positivity narrative that you've got to be positive, you've got to be jolly, you know, even from a Christian perspective, if you read the book of Job, you know, Job was going through loads of difficult hardships in his life. He still complained, he still moaned, he was still upset. But he never lost faith in God. And I think we've got to be open to say, if we're having a bad time and something's not working or something isn't the way we want it, we need to confront it and look at ways we can try to make it better for ourselves, and always be seeking to be better every day. It doesn't mean that you can't be a positive person or see the good in things, but we have to call things for what they are. Mm-hmm. And if someone is having a difficulty that is deemed as, I guess, difficult in your eye, like you don't want to deal with it, if that makes sense, how is that person supposed to thrive if you can't see the beauty in what they have? Autism, you can see the beauty in autistic people if you open your eyes and actually look. But what you're doing is you're just seeing the negatives. You're not seeing the good that person has. When I've come across a lot of autistic people, my husband's autistic, the generosity and the kindness and the love that he has towards me, and the genuine, like, he's very detailed about very specific things that sometimes I'm not really like looking. He'll look at things, he'll watch things that I'm doing, and he'll know that I like this, I know that I like that. And I'm like, how do you know this? And he's like, yeah, I just know what you like, and I know you like things a certain way, and he just remembers those things. But if I was just looking at his difficulty, how could I see the love or the joy in being with someone who has a neurodiverse condition? Mm. But a lot of the time, we're looking at the problem rather than looking at the beauty in it. So, yeah, that's an interesting thing that you said. But yeah, I really do think it's. I think particularly within the African community, we really have a long way to go in terms of really recognizing, like, what really is neurodiversity and what it's not. It's not a curse. It's not something that you should be ashamed of. It's something you should embrace, and it's something you should see the beauty in. And yeah, there might be challenging times, but there are challenging times of people that are neurotypical too. Mm. So can you not see the beauty in beauty in that? If you can see that in neurotypical relationships or having friendships with neurotypicals, they have their shortcomings just as much as neurodiverse people do. Mm. And we just have to look and see beyond that. That's what I believe anyway. Yeah.
Definitely.
I also wanted to ask you more about what you hope for the future in terms of, you've done this book, you're now working as a corporate girly.
trying
to do the corporate thing. Mm-hmm. What are your hopes from the book? Will you write a new one, a second version, or how is it going to go for you?
Sure. Definitely see myself writing a second book, but I do not see myself doing it anytime soon. Life a bit more and have like more to write about. But in all honesty, I want to help people, and I guess one can help people in like a number of different ways. And I'm still looking into this, like how I can like help people, whether it's like pinpointing people to resources that will help them and whatnot. But yeah, I'd probably say the thing that I'm mostly working on at the minute is a petition, which is for state funding for state schools, so people can get diagnosed in school and they don't have to wait till university to do it. And the involvement of psychologists in this, because teachers can't diagnose people because they're not psychologists. So currently have this petition on the Parliament website, and I'd probably say most of my efforts are going to trying to promote that, to get signatures, because I need signatures in order for it to be brought to Parliament, in order for them to discuss it. So I'd probably say that's the future for me, just working on that. Don't really have any major plans. I don't have major plans for what happens afterwards, but that's really something that I'm really passionate about.
I think it's so important that we do get people diagnosed at school, because that's where the root of the problem is. Like, if you don't get the diagnostics at school, then how can you get the support systems in place? And then you're having to navigate all of this by yourself with no support. And then only when you get to the end of your education, it's like, oh, by the way, you went through all of this and you actually had a neurodiverse condition.
Yeah.
And it's not really fair. So, yeah, it's not fair. But it just goes to show that people that do manage to get to that stage obviously have so much resilience that they're just pushing through, like, it's like basically walking with one foot and no crutches, and you're just trying to somehow make it. That's literally that's the only way that I can, because I'm a visual person. So it's like the only way I can describe what it's like being neurodiverse is like having no feet or no legs, and trying to get there like everyone else, and everyone's expecting you to do the same, and it's not really quite the same. So there was something that kind of popped in my head. So when you're navigating neurodiversity, and there's something I put on my page actually, on my socials. So when you are meeting somebody and you want to have a relationship, and maybe you're like, I'm not ready for a relationship, I want to be single, but maybe you might want to get into a relationship that might turn serious.
Mm.
How do you kind of let that person know you have a neurodiverse condition? Because I was watching this Netflix program called Love on the Spectrum, mm-hmm. where you just see people that are going on dates. It's so sweet. It's lovely. I watched the one that was the British one, which I didn't really enjoy as much, but I'm watching the American one at the moment on Netflix. But like, it's so lovely to see, like, you know, not like, I think the one I watched in the UK, this was ages ago before Love on the Spectrum. There was a program on Channel 4. I don't think they show it anymore, but they called The Undateables, which I think is a really horrible title. And I can't believe it went through television, that calling people The Undateables. I don't think it's on anymore, yeah. But it was literally called, that's what the show was called, The Undateables, which were people that had disabilities and they may have a neurodiverse condition, but they were classed as undateable. How can someone be undateable? I don't know how they got away with that title anyway. Mm-hmm. But like...
Yeah.
But how do you navigate love as a young woman that has neurodiversity and meeting an ideal partner for yourself?
So I'm very much like still navigating it. And I think it's hard for me to mask or hide even if I want to be, because of the book now.
Of course.
Yeah, I very much have that conversation early on. And I think a lot of people are still learning more about it and what it means. But yeah, I definitely still navigating it and understanding it, like understanding how to go about it. But yeah, I don't think I've had any like bad like reactions when I mention, oh, I'm neurodiverse, by the way. However, when it comes to some actions, that's when I've seen it. So there was one instance where I went out with someone, and I think maybe I dropped something or bumped into something, or just being a bit clumsy in that instance. And that's due to like just being dyspraxic. And I remember them just getting quite irritated and annoyed with me. So I definitely took that as a mental note of like, yeah, this is not the person, this is not the one. But yeah, most people have been quite gracious, thankfully. But it's definitely something that affects even that area of my life. I wouldn't say neurodiversity just affects me at work or just affects me with academics. Like, even in terms of socializing and relationships is such a big thing. Even in terms of friendships as well, where I've had to say to people, I need a visual aid. If you just tell me something, I'm not going to remember. So, like, then people do need to kind of take it into account. Or, for example, like, God forbid, if I do forget your birthday, please, it's not personal, okay? But this is something that might happen. So you might have to tell me, like, 3 times. Yeah.
I think, yeah, the friends that you keep should understand the friendship group they have. And I think it's important just as much as if you're having romantic relationships to, like, having platonic relationships, that people have to be, like, quite aware of that. I have a neurodiverse condition. Please bear with me. Like, one of my closest friends, I say, like, I'm neurodiverse. You're going to be my friend or not? And she's like, yeah, she's cool. So, and sometimes, like, there's things that I do that I don't realise I'm doing it. And I'll be like, this needs to be done now. And I'm quite, like blunt at times. Mm. So she called me one time, like, you were quite blunt on the phone the other day to me. And I was like, really? Was I? I didn't know I was blunt. She was like, yeah, like, but I thought we had a discussion and then you were saying something else. And I'm like, oh. And she's like, okay, it's fine. I get it. You're dyslexic. You probably forgot we had this conversation. I'm like, yeah, I probably did. but there's having friends that just get you and understand how you what you're about and just giving you that grace. So yeah, but there's some friendship groups that just might not understand it. And I think because when I was younger I think I did lose a lot of friends because like I would turn up late to meet up people and things like that, and I think people probably thought I was taking the mick or I was just a bad friend, but it's just I had time blindness. I didn't realize the time. So I would take longer and I'd just turn up like maybe half an hour. I'm like, oh, I'm not that far away. And they just think, are you like serious? Like, so I think I've probably lost friends for not like turning up to things on time. But it's okay because those kind of friendships then don't work for me, like in the sense that maybe I can work on myself, but also the friendships that you have will give you that grace to kind of be who you are and like help you navigate those shortcomings that you do have. So yeah.
No, it's helpful to know that you have a safe space, but especially with friends and family, like it's needed. If not, you feel like you're masking and that's very tiring.
Oh my gosh, yes, masking. The one thing I find hard to navigate sometimes, and even like I'm putting myself out here a lot with my like neurodiverse condition, so this part of me, and I don't know whether you get this or anyone who's listening can kind of relate to this, is that there's some places that I'm happy to be my complete self, and there's some places that I can't be my complete self because I feel like in my head this person might not be receptive, but at the same time I don't want to affect my opportunities. So it's almost like I'm trying to navigate that, but I'm starting to learn more that, you know, if people don't like you, and this is something that comes to my head of yourself, and this is kind of like that feeling you get like, oh, should I let people know that I have this? I've now kind of said, you know what, if people don't like you, it's okay. Not everyone's gonna like you. You're not gonna be everyone's cup of tea.
Yeah.
That's cool. Like the people that embrace you will embrace you fully, and you'll be fine where you are. And I have to keep telling myself that all the time. Because sometimes there's that little voice in your head that tells you, oh, if you tell people you have this, it's going to jeopardize your opportunities, or if you don't go to this, it's gonna mess things up for you. But actually, it's okay. Like, you don't have to pretend to be something you're not.
Yeah.
But that's something I have to consistently tell myself, like, I literally train my brain to not worry about that. But I don't know whether you get something similar, because this is something I probably am still working on.
No, definitely. But I feel like I've come to a place where I'm just like, this is exhausting. This is tiring for me.
Yeah.
And when it comes to my relationships, when it comes to friendships, when it comes to, like, family, like, I already feel like before navigating this at work, I already felt like I had to mask, and that was tiring enough. So I need that safe space when it comes to my friends and it comes to my family. And if that's not necessarily the case, then it's not really a relationship or place that I need to be. I've recently become very intentional when it comes to places as well. Like if I feel like I'm in a place where I always feel uncomfortable, or whenever I come home, I feel exhausted, I feel tired, or whatever it might be, I try to be quite observant and take note of that. And then if it keeps happening, if I don't need to be, like if it's not paying me, I won't be there.
No, I love that. I think it's good to have that temperature check and feeling, and just knowing if something works for you or not. And sometimes we don't always listen to that because we're always kind of trying to please others. I think a lot of neurodiverse people are people pleasers. That's probably our worst trait, I think. I wouldn't say all, but a lot of us can be like that, where we're just trying to make sure that everybody is happy at the expense of our own mental and physical health at times. But that's something probably that I'm working on myself. So I'll take a chapter in your book and Shay just say that, like, if it's too much, says no, we're done, we're not going to carry on like this, because I need to contain my mental and physical and spiritual health so that I don't have to deal with mad people that just can't accept my neurodiverse conditions. It's too stressful and it's too tiring. So yeah, we're tired. So normally when I kind of come to the end of the podcast, I tend to ask my guests a few questions about what are the sort of five positives of being, and I don't want to say just neurodiversity, what are the five positive things that you hold as with your current neurodiverse condition, and what are the five sort of negatives and how do you overcome them? So let's not just look at negatives, we come with solutions too. Yeah. So I might make it three because five is quite a lot. So we'll do three, yeah. So what are the positives of having three positives, three negatives, and then solutions? Yeah.
I'd probably say number one, probably resilience. And I'd probably say number two, multi-dimensional thinking. I think I'm able to see things from like different perspectives or different viewpoints. And I'd probably say the last one would be I want to say creativity, but I think that's very like broad. But yeah, I definitely think that's like a strength.
Creativity can come in any format.
Yeah. Yeah.
Any format, not just singing or writing. It could be like the fact that you're able to do, the fact you're multifaceted. Like, I find a lot of people that are neurodiverse have what you call portfolio-based careers, which means they're able to work for themselves, but they can also work for other people and they can kind of merge into and not one as the other. So creativity can come in how you create your life, literally. Yeah. And what are the three negatives that you find the neurodiverse with the condition that you have, which is dyspraxia and dyslexia?
Yeah. I'd say like one major negative is I think I can be discouraged and dismayed when it comes to just taking longer to do certain things. I acknowledge it does take me longer to do certain things. So that's one. I'd say another one would probably be I don't necessarily think it's a negative, but I think sometimes just having to gauge and just having to reread and just having to double check sometimes. So I think, yeah, it can be a negative in a way because it can be tiring to do that all the time. And it can be tiring to be like, oh, is this, am I seeing things for what they really are? Or, you know, or even when it comes to writing things, sometimes it can be tiring to always have to, you know, spell check, grammar, all of that good stuff there. And lastly, I'd probably say for like a negative, I wish I was better at planning. I wish I was better at organizing. But I'm not, and I've definitely had to find ways to try and navigate that. But yeah, I wish it's something that came naturally to me.
What do you think you've done to try and make yourself kind of manage these negatives or the things that I see as challenges for you, I would say?
Yeah, probably start with the planning and organising. I know this is not my strength, so there's two things I might do, which is give myself more time, because I know like it's going to take me more time to do that. Yeah, I'm definitely going to try and procrastinate and not do it because I don't want to do it. And also more time because it might take me a bit longer. And sometimes, if possible, ask for like some help, whether that's friends, whether that's family, like maybe that's a gift that they have or something that they're really good at. So I'll ask them to help. Or, for example, if it's like a project or that one's working on, I won't take that role of planning and organizing. I won't take that responsibility on. I will focus on the things that I know come easy to me. And then another strength I said was just like taking more time to do things. I think I've really learned to just enjoy doing things at my own pace and just knowing that what is for me is for me. Like, I'm in no competition with anyone other than like probably myself, if anything else. Life is literally like a marathon. Like, there's no rush. And I'd probably say it's just acknowledging there's no rush. I guess it depends on what it is that you're doing, but just try and take a bit more ownership in the things that I do so I can dictate the time that I need, so the time frame works for me if possible. And then what was the other strength I said? I don't remember, and I've not answered them in order.
That's okay.
What was the other weakness that I said? I think I said taking more time. Oh, double check in.
Yeah, double check in.
I acknowledge I need to do that. If I do not do that, there will be a so I force, I now realise that whether I like or not, I need to do it. So
you need to double check.
Yeah.
I think everyone needs to double check, although us neurodiverse people do have to double check a lot more, which yeah, it can be incredibly exhausting because you're like, oh, I don't want to do this. Sometimes I get other people to check if they're willing to do so.
Yeah.
If they're willing to do so, I'll try and get someone else to do it for me. But yeah, it's a very exhausting thing. Like, I think I've written it right. And then you look at it, it's like, no, that made no sense. Oh, Shay, you've given me so much wisdom on this podcast, so that I am so grateful that you're on here. Where can the audience members find your details, where to get the book? Because we want more people to buy your book so it can become even more of a bestseller. Give us your details, please.
So people can connect with me on LinkedIn. And it's literally just my name, Shay Jedekin. Instagram as well, created a page called Black Neurodiverse. They can follow just updates of maybe what I'll be up to there. And then the book, that people can buy it on Amazon. And I also realized that not everyone's going to read a book. So there's also an audiobook that they can listen to if they want to.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you so much, Shay, for coming on to Divine and Egma. We appreciate your time, your wisdom, your experience and your honesty, and just being so open about what you've gone through as a neurodiverse Black woman in the UK. And we hope that we find more of us that can talk about our journey and our experience. And yeah, we're there, we're hidden, but a lot of us just were hidden in the corporate sector, in the business world landscape, but we want more of us to come out and talk about our lived experience. So thank you again for coming on the podcast. What's that?
I said I've really enjoyed today.
Oh, okay, good. I'm glad you did. Okay, thank you so much. I want to let our audience members know about the 6-week coaching program that I'll be offering people who are neurodivergent, or you could be neurotypical and you want to either improve your career prospects in general, start a business, or want to get into project management. I mentioned this earlier in previous episodes, but I want to make the time to offer it up again for those who are looking to improve in these areas in their life. Also, I also have a membership platform coming up for people who have ADHD and dyslexia. And this membership platform will have a whole host of resources and experts to help you navigate how to manage your dyslexia and ADHD. It will also be there to help you with CV coaching, interview coaching, mentorship, in-person meetups. There'll be just so much resources for you. And up until the 1st of April, if you join annually and you join the waiting list, it's £150 for the whole year. If you wanted to, you can pay £25 a month for the membership. I'm also doing coaching sessions, and I'll do specific quotes for you. So if you email me at hello@divineenigma.org, I'm also offering support to people who want to pass the Prince 2 practitioner exam, because I've taken the exam and I failed. And I'd like to give you some of the techniques I use to ensure that I've passed the exam. Now, if this sounds interesting to you, or you'd just like to learn more, please reach out to me directly at hello@divineenigma.org, or you can reach out to me via my social media, which is Instagram, YouTube, and I've just literally gone on TikTok, so you can also find me at Divine Enigma on TikTok as well. So, like I always like to say, please follow me on all platforms where you listen to podcasts. Thank you so much for listening to Divine Enigma. And if you got to the end, this is a safe place for project managers and professionals to give you the tools and tips on how to navigate the complexity of being neurodiverse in the workplace and also within the business hemisphere if you're wanting to start your own business. All right then, take care, and I will see you guys soon. Bye for now.
So before you go, I know I've ended the show, but I just want to let you guys know one extra thing. So I just want to thank you again. I'm so happy that you guys are on listening to Divine Enigma. I'm so gracious and grateful for each, every single one of you. And your support of the show just makes Divine Enigma produce content as often as possible. However, just so that you're so more invested in the community at Divine Enigma, you can become a monthly subscriber of the show from as little as $3 a month, or you can pay a one-off fee of $5, which is equivalent to a cup of coffee, to support the show. It allows us to put together exclusive content and ensure that we are producing the best type of information for people that are neurodiverse, and also those who want to start businesses and get in the corporate world managing their neurodiverse condition. We really, really hope that your compassion and your care in supporting neurodiverse courses, particularly Divine Enigma, will ensure that we as a business can continue to flourish. So yeah, we ask for as much support as you can. If you sign up as a regular donator, from a minimum fee of $3 a month, we can give you more exclusive content. And again, if you want to, you can also give a one-off fee from $5 to ensure the show is running successfully. So that's all I've got to say. That's all I've got to say right now. And I really hope you guys have an amazing day, week, month, wherever you are in the world. Just remember, to support the show in whatever way possible. I'll see you on the next episode. Bye for now.